Welcome to the Culture Perth and Kinross podcast. This week, Senior Librarian Kirsty Brown caught up with Strathearn-based crime writers Tracy Emerson and Helen Grant as part of Strathearn Festival of the Arts Literary Showcase, hosted by Culture Perth and Kinross. Join them as they discuss the influence Strathearn has had on their work and the effect that lockdown has had on them as authors.
Hi, I'm Kirsty Brown and I'm a Senior Officer with Culture Perth and Kinross Libraries. And I, along with the amazing team, look after Strathearn Community Library. I'm absolutely delighted that Culture Perth and Kinross are taking part in the Strathearn Online Festival of the Arts. I think it's a tremendous way of celebrating local arts and culture, and the fact that hopefully we're being seen right across the world makes it even better. Great that we can share our local talent. Over the past few months, I know that reading and books have been a huge part of people's lives, and there's been a huge gap left by the library. We've all really missed seeing everybody, and I know that people have struggled without the library books. So it's great that we can possibly fill a little gap this evening by being part of the festival and keeping libraries and books alive. So this evening, we're here to think about how Strathearn can inspire authors and what better way than inviting two wonderful Strathearn authors. Helen Grant and Tracy Emerson are local and they're going to talk about how Strathearn has inspired them in their writing. Helen, who lives in Crieff's first novel, The Vanishing of Katerina Lyndon, was published in 2009 and was shortlisted for the prestigious Carnegie Award. The last novel that she's working on is called Ghost, and it's actually set in Crieff. Tracy, who lives in St. Fillan's, has lots of short stories published. She has a PhD in creative writing, and her first novel, She Chose Me, has been described as fast-paced, dark, and very unsettling. So tonight we're going to have a wee chat about how you got your inspiration, what you think about living in Strathearn. So I'm going to start with Tracy first. And Tracy, could you just give us a little bit of a feeling as to why you started writing and a bit background?
Sure. Well, my writing journey's been a very circuitous one. I didn't start writing seriously until I was in my early 30s. But when I look back sort of to being a child, I always wanted to write then. And I wrote short stories, and I was absolutely obsessed with Joan March from Little Women, and I wanted to be her, I wanted to be a writer like her. And I was also a huge reader. It was the 1970s, we didn't have a lot of money, and I think my parents just sort of plied me with books to keep me occupied, really. So that was a really big part of my childhood. And my dad was in the army, and when I was about 8 or 9 years old, he got posted to Kuwait, and we went out there to live with him. And I would say life changed very dramatically for me then. And even though I was still reading and I still enjoyed literature and writing at school, home life became very much about being outdoors, you know, being at the beach, swimming. And it was just very, very different. We'd gone from the kind of relative misery of 1970s Britain to sort of this very sunny, exotic and dramatic place. And we were lucky enough to spend sort of the next 7 years abroad in the Middle East and the Far East. And I think that experience of traveling and living in these countries where your senses were constantly stimulated, I think now that's something that sort of really fed into my later writing. But for me at school, sort of, I started getting into drama and theatre, and that became a thread that continued throughout my education. And I actually went on to do an undergraduate degree in drama at Bretton Hall College, which was part of Leeds University. And it was a very, I suppose, radical kind of left-wing arts university, and a place that really kind of stimulated my imagination and creativity. It was fantastic. And I left there and became a jobbing actor for a while, which was fun. And also went on to keep traveling, doing a lot of traveling. And I had no inkling then that I wanted to write. But what happened for me, and it's actually a very similar story for a lot of writers, was that I actually had a period of ill health. In the late 90s, I had a sort of a health crisis, my relationship at the time ended. And I think, I suppose, I had a sort of breakdown. And that really led me back into books, into reading. And a friend of mine at the time said to me, look, why don't you start writing? You know, it's a way for you to connect with your creativity. And that's what I started to do, just from keeping journals. But I didn't really know how to get myself going. And I really needed some kind of structure. And I started going to writing classes at the Open Learning Centre in Edinburgh University. And I did a number of writing courses there. And whilst I was on one of the courses, I wrote a short story called Our Big Day Out. And I was advised to submit it to what was then the Orange and Scotsman Short Story Competition. And I did that. It was the first thing I'd ever submitted. And very bizarrely, it was the runner-up story. And this really kind of kick-started everything for me, because it gave me some confidence. It gave me that boost to keep writing. And I continued to write and publish short stories. And eventually I ended up doing a creative writing master's at the University of Edinburgh, which I really enjoyed. And then for some masochistic reason, I stayed on and I did a PhD in creative writing. And the novel that I wrote as that part of that PhD, many incarnations later, became She Chose Me. And that was the novel that got me my literary agent, and it was finally published in 2018. So really, it's been a very long and circuitous journey for me, but an interesting one. So that's me. That's how I came to be writing.
Really, really interesting. Helen, do you have a similar story? I'm always fascinated to hear how writers start off. What about you, Helen? How's your journey developed?
I have got some things in common with Tracy. For example, I lived abroad for a while. I think I wanted to write since I was a child. I can remember when I was 10 that the teacher in our classroom said, what do all of you want to do when you grow up? What do you want to be? And I remember putting my hand up and saying, I'd like to be a writer. So I knew, but a lot of things got in the way. So obviously there was finishing school, there was university, and following university I had to try and find a job, so I was kind of very embroiled in that. And so I worked for 10 years, and during that time all of my spare money went on traveling, so I traveled to about 30 different countries, and most of what I wrote during that time was travel diaries, a little bit of short stories, but that was probably all. In 1998, my daughter was born. So at that point, I stopped work and I was at home. But then shortly after that, we moved to Germany, not long after my son was born. So there I was at home with a toddler and a new baby in a foreign country. And again, there wasn't really time for anything other than dealing with the situation that I was in. But when my son went to kindergarten when he was 3, so that was 2003, all of a sudden, 5 days a week, I had the morning free. So I decided that I would start writing because I'd always wanted to. And given that we were living in Germany, I couldn't, and in a small town in Germany as well, I couldn't really go back to the job that I'd had before, which was marketing. And that is really kind of a 40-hour a week type of job. And it's just not compatible with small children, particularly if you don't have any infrastructure there to look after them. So I started writing. And the very first thing that I had published was a non-fiction piece about Steinfeld Abbey, because that is a real life setting that was used by the great ghost story writer M.R. James to write his story, The Treasure of Abbot Thomas. So I went and visited it and wrote an article about, you know, is this really like the story or is it different? And kind of spoiler, it was different. And that was the first thing I got published. Then I wrote some short stories, and finally I kind of slowly worked my way up to writing a full novel. And that was The Vanishing of Katharina Lyndon. But by the time that got published, bearing in mind I'd started doing this in 2003, it was now 2009. So that was quite a long road. It took me 6 years to get something published. Since then, I've written another 6 novels, which have been published, and I've written another one which is at the moment out on submission, and I'm writing another one as well. I'm quite a prolific person. So that's how I got into it. I think as well that I would add that being abroad really helped, not just because I was forced to do something which I could do at home, but because I was surrounded by people that didn't know me. So nobody was going to say, ha, you know, you really think you're going to write a novel, because they didn't know. If I said I was a writer, they believed me.
So very different now then for both of you. You're both living in, well, Tracy's in St. Fillan's, you're in Crieff Hell, and people know you. So you can't have that anonymity now. So how do you feel your relationship? You've obviously been abroad. How do you feel your relationship with the Strathearn area inspires your writing now? Because you've obviously both, you know, been done an awful lot, and now you're here. So how do you feel you're inspired locally? Tracy, how do you feel you're inspired?
I mean, I think this is an area really that I've been connected to since I moved to Scotland. I moved up here in 1995, and I lived in Edinburgh, but a friend of mine had a place up here, and we would often come up at the weekends, and I just absolutely loved it. And when in the late sort of 90s, early noughties, when I was trying to write and trying to kind of regain my creativity, this is an area I came to often. I would do a lot of reading and a lot of walking. And I moved up here full-time in 2010, and it's been my base ever since. And I think for me, even though it is my base now, I do still have the feeling of being an outsider. And as Helen said, there's sort of an advantage to that, because, I mean, people do know me up here. But because of the space you have up here, you still have a certain amount of anonymity. And I like that. And obviously I'm English as well, you know, living in Scotland. So there's that slight outsider feeling. And I think for me, one of the biggest benefits of living up here, and it sounds very silly, but it's very simple, and that's the ability to walk. And a lot of writers talk about how important walking is to the writing process, because it can be a chance to sort of, you know, this kind of rhythmical sort of physical activity really helps you to clear your mind, to sort of let ideas percolate. And it's certainly a part of my, you know, creative process. I walk every day, and we've got lovely walks just on the doorstep here. So I feel very fortunate with that. And last year, for various reasons, we had to be in Edinburgh a lot. And I found that I really missed these daily walks that I have. And it was as if part of my creative brain didn't work as well because I wasn't up here. And when we then came back and I was back into doing this daily routine of walking these particular paths, it was as if pathways in my brain then sort of woke up and I kind of rediscovered old ideas that I'd forgotten about. So it's almost as though like the sort of landscape and the countryside has sort of become enmeshed with my thinking and with my way of working, and that's become really important to me.
That is interesting, the fact that going through to Edinburgh you felt everything just kind of closing in and coming back here. I'm not a writer in any way, shape or form, but I can thoroughly relate to the space. For thinking. Helen, what about you?
Well, I would say that that being here is very important to me as a writer at the moment. I've always tended to write about the place that I live in. So my first three books were set in Germany because I was living there. And then we moved to Flanders. We were quite close to Brussels. So my next three books were set there. And then we moved to Scotland. And my most recent book, which is called Ghost, is actually set sort of in and around Crieff. And I think that this is partly because I respond very much to what is around me, and I'm inspired by it as well. It would be quite difficult for me to be inspired by somewhere that I wasn't or that I wasn't seeing. And I think there is also that element, as Tracy said, of having come in from somewhere else. I mean, I feel very at home here. I've lived here for 9 years now. My husband's Scot, so I don't really feel like an outsider, I don't think. But the fact that I'm so far away from where I grew up and from my family, bless them, has maybe maintained a bit of that confidence I had from being abroad, that if I say to people that I'm a writer, they're going to believe me. They're not going to be, oh, flipping heck, you know, I was at school with Helen Grant, she can't write for Toffee. You know, I don't have to worry about that. I feel that I can be what I want to be.
You've both talked about the huge influence the location has on your writing. How does this actually work? I mean, you've said that you walk Tracy. Do you go somewhere and the ideas pop into your head, or how do you choose a place to set your book? All these kind of ideas.
I think, yeah, with that, with the kind of connection with walking, that's very much if I'm working on something and then I take an idea out for walk, it will develop as I'm walking, or something will just come in randomly. So there's that connection just with the immediate location. In terms of location and novel writing, I think it's an incredibly, you know, where you set your novel is incredibly important. And a lot of writers talk about location being another character in the novel. And I think that's true. I mean, having said that, for me, it's not usually a starting point, but it becomes very important as the novel develops. So, for example, in my first novel, She Chose Me, that's set in London. And that was quite important because there's a stalker element in the novel. And that's much easier to kind of pull off and to believe if you've got that kind of thing taking place in a large, sprawling city. And I also wanted both of the characters to be a bit lost and a bit anonymous. And that worked better in London as well. And I quite enjoy, I mean, Helen and I were talking before how you'll often have, you know, a real place, but you'll make an imaginary setting within it. So, you know, you might make up it's London, but you've made up the cafe that the characters are in. But often I like to do a bit of very precise research as well. So when I was researching She Chose Me and I was in London, I knew that I wanted Grace, the main character, to be living in sort of an ex-council high rise. And I went to a local estate agent, like to a Foxton's, and I found a couple of properties that looked like what I wanted. And I pretended that I wanted to buy them so that the guy would take me to look at them. Which he did, and that was great because I was able to actually go into them and have a little feel for them. So that was a good bit of undercover fun, which I really enjoyed. And for the novel that I'm writing at the moment, A Careless Man, before I knew much about it, I knew that I wanted the first part to be set in Edinburgh and for it to be happening in November and to be very grey and very dull. And I knew I wanted the second part to be set in Europe somewhere, really sunny, and for it to be a total contrast. And in the end, I settled sort of on Mallorca, and I was able to go there. And I think sometimes there's a great advantage in going to the settings that you're, or being in the settings that you're writing about. I'm sure Helen will have experienced this as well, that often you'll get ideas for plot from location. You know, so you'll witness a scene, or you'll just see something, and you'll think, oh yeah, that's how I can use that. So location's important in many ways.
So Helen, you're obviously in the perfect situation for this latest novel, that you're in Crieff and it's set in Crieff. How do you feel that your location fits into your writing?
It's absolutely central to it, really. I've had people comment on the fact before that sometimes the location feels as important as another character in the story, and I think that's probably true. I think that all of my books could only take place in wherever it is that they are. And in terms of Ghost, which is this book, it sets in Crieff, in areas around Crieff, and I imagine the country house that a lot of it's set in, although it's an imaginary one, I imagine it being round about Fowlis Wester. I know there isn't anything like that exactly there, but that's where I imagine it as being, and everything else kind of is geographically correct around that. So the book features Turlham Hill, it features James Square in Crieff, somebody drops dead in the middle of that. It features Ferntower Road, there's an unspecified property there, and various other places like this. And where there is something that I feel as though there might be an issue in terms of either kind of naming a business or identifying somebody's personal property, then I've made an imaginary place for that. But otherwise, these are real places, and it is quite important to me that I should be able to walk through them and feel them and experience them. For me, in a lot of ways, the thing that is important to spend the creative time on is the story. So I don't actually want to be making up a location as well. I want it to be a real one. And I also feel as well that sometimes walking through it and feeling it and touching it and smelling it are the things that gives me the ideas. So as I say, so my last book was very, very much was based in the local area. The one that I've just finished writing that's out on submission is based on in an imaginary country house between Crieff and Comrie. And that came basically from seeing there was a place on the map that was called the Black Hill. So I thought, OK, I'm going to create a place called called Black Hill and have a house there. And the one that I'm writing at the moment is completely imaginary, but say is again in a real location. So, yeah, so it's very, very important to me that. And I think that kind of walking the walk and smelling the smells and touching things is really key to getting ideas.
Wonderful. So obviously over the last few months, life has been very, very different for you both. And I just wondered how that has influenced your writing. Has it made it easier for you? Has it been harder for you? Like I would have thought it would have been harder for you, but you might prove me wrong and tell me totally different. Has it helped or has it hindered, Tracy?
I think it's been a bit of a mixed bag, but mostly it's helped because at the very start of lockdown, I was in a position where I had to really push through to the end of a novel draft so I could send it to my agent. And, you know, it would have been a kind of couple of months where there'd been a lot of interruptions, a lot of coming and going from Edinburgh. So to suddenly kind of wake up and be told, like, nobody can come and see you. You can't go anywhere. You know, nobody in your life can arrange things that you have to go and do was sort of, despite the obvious disastrous situation, was a bit of a godsend in that way. So I was really able to push through, finish my novel draft, send it off to my agent and a couple of other people so I could get feedback. So that was very constructive, and I got a lot from that. And also I think writers probably felt a little bit smug during lockdown because in a way, we've kind of already mentally adapted to that sort of situation in that we do spend sort of long periods of time alone, looking terrible in sweatpants, you know, feeling very uncertain about our kind of jobs or our work or whether it's actually going to go anywhere. So that kind of situation we sort of already had a slight sort of bit of experience of. Later on, when I sort of was getting feedback from people and I realised that, okay, I'm going to have to change some things, I'm going to have to go back in and rewrite, that was slightly harder because, you know, normally I'd kind of have a bit of a, you know, stamp my feet and a cry, and then I would go out and see a few friends, have a few drinks, and then sort of feel that I could come back to the drawing board refreshed. But there wasn't that support network there. So it's been a little bit more tiring to have to kind of motivate myself to kind of think, right, okay, I have to get my energy up again. I have to kind of, you know, tackle a kind of rewrite. And so it has kind of been a mixed bag in that way. But in terms of having, you know, more time to kind of read and write, that side of it's been very useful.
Imagine that as you say, as a job, it's not like you're having to go out to the office every day. So from that respect, it isn't too different.
But no, I can see the daily routine is very much the same.
Yeah, but I can see the motivation. If you need that kind of pushing and friends to help you, then yeah, that's I can see why that would have been hard. Helen, what about you? Has it helped or hindered?
At the beginning of the lockdown, I would say that it was pretty much disastrous in terms of writing. Thankfully, I had just finished writing one book. That was the last one. So that had kind of gone off for the agent to read. But all of a sudden, less than 48 hours before lockdown, we went and fetched our two adult children from university. And I'm very, very grateful that we did that because I would have worried dreadfully about them if they hadn't been at home with us. But that meant that we went, with my husband also working at home, we went from this environment where every day I had sort of from 7:30 in the morning till maybe 7 or 8 o'clock at night on my own to write. All of a sudden, there's four people in the house, plus we were trying to order food in as opposed to going out and buying it. So I was cooking a lot of stuff from scratch. So I was actually spending kind of virtually all of my time just doing that, cooking for four people, going for our daily exercise walk. And there was no space or time. There was never any time when there wasn't somebody else in the house with me. So it was a bit of a disaster. And I'd say that for the first sort of month or two, I just thought, well, okay, I'm going to go with this because, you know, there's no alternative. So I did other work. I do some work as a copy editor and proofreader. So I just tried to catch up with all of that. So, you know, fine, that was what I did. And I was very productive with that, but I didn't do any writing. But I would say that over the last sort of 3 weeks or so, I've suddenly started writing again. And I think that partly this is because we've sort of reached a level. We all kind of have adjusted to being together. Plus, there's the fact that some of the things that I was doing before, like workshops, I'm not doing anymore because I can't do them. So although, you know, I'm sorry not to have the income from that, it does mean that all of a sudden I've thought, well, wow, I have actually got more time. So I've started working on this new book, and I've been working on it for about 2 weeks, and I've got 16,000 words already. And I'm not saying these are perfect words. These are words that haven't been revised yet, but that's quite good for me. And I think that's because I'm actually genuinely able to focus on this and not on anything else. So I would say that sort of now it's quite good, but at the beginning it was absolutely desperate. It was dreadful.
Yeah, I could believe that. Just it's that lack of space, isn't it? And as you say, dealing with all these people coming back into the house, and it felt like there just wasn't enough time to fit anything in. At the beginning, I think a lot of people felt like that. So although again, I'm not a writer, I can relate to that. How do you think this is going to influence writing in the future? Do you think people are going to, there's going to be a whole load of books, novels all set around what we've been through? Or do you think people might just put it aside, that people want to think of happier things again? How do you think COVID is going to feature in the writing of the future?
Can I answer that one first, maybe?
Yes, of course.
Some thoughts about this, because actually I've got really quite a big serious problem with this, because the book that I'm writing at the moment, the one that I've just started writing, is based on the assumption that one of the characters in it is 105 years old. So she can remember a lot of things that happened a long time ago. But that is probably about the furthest extent that you can kind of credibly go with a character. You can't make them 120 because it's pretty unlikely that they would still be alive. And so consequently, I've actually got to think, what am I going to do about COVID? Because if I set the book in 2018, that's fine. You know, that's going to work in terms of her age and the other aspects of the book. But there is also this feeling, will people want to read something that's set in the past like that? Not far enough back to be interesting, but just old enough to feel stale, maybe. Or I can't set it this year because otherwise I'd have to put COVID in it. But if I set it next year or the year after, I don't actually know what the world is going to be like. And I mean, it's not just COVID, there's Brexit as well. And if it were that things are disastrous or weird or just different, you know, how do I put that into the book now? And that is actually quite a serious problem that I haven't really resolved. So at the moment, I'm writing it as though there isn't any COVID going on, but I'm going to have to think about this before I get to the end and make a decision.
I know I don't actually watch the programme EastEnders, but I know that they made that conscious decision that although they were going to be filming 2 metres apart, COVID was just not going to feature in EastEnders. And it's just working out what do you do with it? What about you, Tracy? Have you had any?
I think it is interesting. I think, like Helen said, it is going to be a bit of a dilemma. I mean, the thing is as well to remember, like with the publishing industry, there's a big time lag between a piece of work being finished and being published. So even if you finish your work, you send it to your agent and you sell it, there can be a year to 2 year gap between it being published. So at the moment, there's already a lag with publishing, apparently, because there's been a lot of titles that were due to be published this year that have been pushed back maybe 6 months that are going to be coming out. So you presume that the whole production line somehow is going to be slightly slowed down. So even if you were getting a publishing deal at the end of this year, you're probably looking, you know, at probably 2022 before you might get published. So there's those kind of considerations going on. So there'll be works in the pipeline that were written pre-COVID that are going to come out that won't have anything to do with COVID. I mean, I don't think that that's it. I don't think it's a huge problem for readers in that, I mean, I'm reading stuff now that's obviously written pre-COVID and I don't have an issue with it. I don't feel I need to be reading things that are reflecting the COVID experience at the moment. And I have read letters from agents and editors saying, you know, for God's sake, the last thing we want to read right now is a COVID novel, you know, so don't send them, which I thought was interesting. And I think it will come to feature a lot, perhaps, especially in TV dramas. I think there's going to be a lot of kind of really good TV drama come around from all of the kind of idea of people being enclosed and all the different things that have gone on. But I think it's going to take a while for it to kind of maybe show up in novels, because a lot of the time things that happen that are quite dramatic, it takes time for them to settle and then kind of the stories start to come out of them. So I do think it's going to be there. And I don't know whether that means there's going to be a great glut of historical fiction because it's easier to go backwards. You know, I really don't know. The thing I'm working on at the moment, A Careless Man, in my mind, even before COVID, I had part one set in around 2010 and part two set in 2015. But I wasn't going to mention the specific dates. It was just going to be apparent that it was a now. But I may have to revise that. I may have to actually put that part one is 2010 and, you know, part two is 2015. So I think those things are considerations. And I mean, you know, like Helen said, I just don't know. And we don't know what the world's going to be like in a couple of years' time. So it's probably easier to go back than it is to go forward at the moment, maybe. I'm not sure.
I think you could possibly have a whole debate, a whole week of lectures just on that one particular subject. It's a very, very big subject. I think we wouldn't have thought to have done something like this before COVID. And I think it's so interesting. I think it's wonderful that we've had the opportunity this evening to speak to each other like this. And the fact that we can, your thoughts are being, can now be shared right across the world. Before, if we had had an author visit, people are stuck to, if you can get to Crieff, then you could come and hear you. But I think it's absolutely wonderful that tonight your thoughts have been hopefully shared maybe right across the world. And before COVID, we wouldn't have thought to have done that. So maybe that's one positive that's come out of it. Helen and Tracy are going to both read a passage from one of their books, Tracy's book and one of Helen's books. And also just to say that I'm sure that once you've heard them, you will want to read more. And I know that we've got some of Helen's books available in ebook and possibly e-audiobook. Tracy's book, unfortunately, we don't have it in ebook format, Tracy, but we've got quite a few copies of the book. So people will be able to request your books. So yeah, over to you for a snippet of reading.
The novel that I'm working on at the moment is called A Careless Man, and it's about a middle-aged man called Julian Griggs. And he's been a full-time carer for his wife, Helen, for about 10 years after she was left partially disabled and brain damaged after a car accident. And at the start of the novel, we find Julian utterly at the end of his tether with his situation. And the story takes a very dark turn when he meets an unhinged stranger called Gabriel, who offers to kill Helen and to set Julian free from his responsibilities. And I wanted Julian's first encounter with Gabriel to take place away from his Edinburgh home, and it needed to be somewhere secluded. So in the story, Julian manages to get a couple of nights away as a respite break. And although I originally had him going to Northumberland, I decided last week to change this to him staying in a caravan on Loch Earn. So I'm just going to read a short extract of him arriving in the area, just so you can see how I've been using the Strathearn area sort of in the novel. And in this extract, he's been told that he's going to be staying in Lochview Caravan Park. Lochview Caravan Park turned out to consist of two static caravans on the south side of Loch Earn, a secluded spot just off the South Loch Earn Road, populated by ancient twisted oak trees and towering silver birches. The unoccupied caravan next to his had green curtains drawn across every window. Julian found the key safe beside his caravan's front door with the key inside, just as the owner had promised. When he unlocked the door and stepped inside, the musty air suggested he might be the first occupant for some time. He turned on the tap over the small kitchen sink. After a moment's gurgling hesitation, water gushed out. The gas fire beside the bedroom door billowed into life when he switched it on, everything in working order. When he returned outside to unload the car, autumn leaves submitted to his boots with a dry whisper. He paused to admire the russet brown pelts of the hills on both sides of the lock and their reflections in the water's surface. It was a cold, clear autumn day, but a mass of grey cloud lurked at the far end of the lock. It didn't take him long to unpack his clothes and the few food supplies he'd brought with him. The caravan's basic kitchen contained only a small fridge, kettle, microwave, and two ring hob, but Julian didn't care. The place would do for a couple of nights. As well as a bedroom, it had a small bathroom with a working toilet and shower, and the large window at the far end of the caravan's living area looked out onto the lock. Above the window stretched a shelf of tattered books. Below it, a bench covered in faded pink cushions ran along the rear and adjacent walls. In front of the benches, a table had been screwed into the floor. The caravan's decor had a dated feel. Wood chip wallpaper painted grubby yellow, horse brasses on the walls, and a wooden ship's wheel on the back of the bathroom door. He sat at the table and gazed at the lock and the rocky foreshore. If Helen were here, she would have left him to unpack while she went exploring. She would be on the beach already, removing shoes and socks and rolling up her jeans for a paddle in the icy water. He retrieved his phone from his backpack and called Linda, the capable middle-aged woman assigned to look after his wife in his absence. "She's doing grand," Linda assured him in a cheery voice. "We're getting on like a house on fire." When he'd said goodbye to Helen that morning, she'd screamed as if the house was on fire, thrown a tantrum violent enough for him to consider cancelling the holiday, but Linda had insisted he go. Now she told him to get off the phone and enjoy himself. "Make the most of a little you time," she said. "I will." He paused. "Please give Helen my love." After hanging up, he checked his watch. Almost 1 p.m. He could please himself for the rest of the day and all of tomorrow too. The thought made him lightheaded. He didn't know what to do first. Catch up on some sleep? Indulge in a long shower, a luxury he never had time for at home. He decided to walk. He put on his waterproof jacket and walking boots and set off from the caravan, turning left and heading towards the bridge that linked the road with the village of St. Fillan's. Dark clouds had gathered over the lock and a vigorous wind whipped the slate grey water into waves. The kind of autumn wind, he thought, that would soon strip the remaining leaves from the trees around him. His senses awakened. He inhaled the damp, earthy scent of fallen, decaying leaves. He heard the sharp, keen cries of a buzzard circling overhead and the mirth of ducks echoing across the lock. His arms swung beside him as he walked, and he relished their freedom from wheelchair duty. It was good to move at his own pace. At times, his wife's limitations became his own, and he almost forgot he had an able body. He resolved to exercise more. Maybe he should start running again. It wouldn't take him long to shed a few pounds, and the fitter he was, the more energy he would have to devote to Helen. Optimism bloomed within him as he envisaged this fitter, healthier, happier self. He would start today, now. He eyed the imposing hill that rose up behind the stone villas and cottages of St. Fillan's and decided to see how much of it he could climb. When he reached the bridge, the rain from the far end of the lock reached him, vast sheets of it moving across the water. It needled his face and soon seeped through his inadequate waterproof. He worried he might get soaked and catch a cold and then pass that cold to Helen, who might suffer another chest infection. The thought of it made his bones ache with weariness. He turned and headed back.
I just want to hear more. I just want to hear more, Tracy. So when is the book out?
It won't be for a while. I'm just working on another rewrite, and then I'll be in that kind of COVID queue of publication, I imagine. So hopefully not too long. We'll see.
Great. That's just, it was wonderful. Just, I was there, totally there. It was wonderful. Thank you, Helen.
Right, I'm going to read a short piece from Ghost, which is already published, because I frequently mention to people the fact that somebody drops dead in James Square, so I thought perhaps I should read that bit. Just as a little bit of background to what's happening in the book, Tom, who is one of the two narrators, there's two different narrators in this story, and one of them is Tom, who's a young man who has been up to this place, Langland's house, to do some necessary repair work, but people hardly ever go up there because the person that lives there is very reclusive. And while he was there, he had an experience of thinking that he saw something strange, but he isn't sure whether he did or he didn't. So that's the background to that. And this chapter is written from Tom's point of view, as he thinks about that. Tom. Christmas passes, then January. We're into February now, and I still think about Langlands a lot more often than I'd like. What I saw up there, or thought I saw, the girl in the weird old-fashioned dress. There are no such things as ghosts. That's a fact, right? There are people who believe in them, but there are also people who believe in astrology and Elvis still being alive and donuts being found on Mars. But if I didn't see a ghost, what did I see? That's the question, and there's no good answer. Hallucinations are not a good thing to have. They're either a sign of your brain giving way or else taking too much of something. It wasn't the second one, so that leaves something wrong with my brain. Nothing else has happened since that day. I haven't seen zombies shambling down the high street or anything, so I'm hoping nothing's seriously wrong with me. Still, it's there at the back of my mind. She looked so real as I am. I try not to think about it because it's a mystery I'm not going to solve, but it still bugs me. Then something happens that makes me think about it all over again. I'm in the town paying in checks at the bank for Dad, and when that's done, I start walking back up the street towards the spot where I've left Mum's little car. About a third of the way up the hill, the street opens out into a square. A couple of months ago, the town Christmas tree was here and the whole square was lit up with coloured light. Now all that's gone. And since it's a freezing day, you'd think people would be in a hurry to get from one side of the square to the other and into a nice warm shop. But looking ahead, I see a small group of people standing around something. As I get level, I see someone's on the ground. I can't help looking. It's a small town, the same old faces, so there's a good chance it's someone I know. And it is. Only it's not someone from the town. It's old Mrs. McAndrew from Langlands. I stop and stare, and right away I'm sure she's dead. She's not injured or anything, not that I can see. She just looks totally still and lifeless, like a block of something, wood or stone, or meat, I think, revolting myself. Her eyes are slightly open, but all you can see is white, like the white part of a fried egg. That makes me feel slightly queasy too. I guess I've made some kind of sound because a woman turns around and looks at me. I've called the ambulance, she tells me. A couple of other passers-by slow down to see what's going on, and eventually the same woman starts telling them to move on and stop staring to give the old lady some room. She's one of those people who like to take charge. She'll probably tell the ambulance crew off when they get here for not managing it in a shorter time. There's nothing I can do. In fact, there's plainly nothing anyone can do for Mrs. McAndrew, so I walk on in the end. Inside, I feel strange. I've just seen a dead body. I expect they'll say she died in hospital or dead on arrival or something, but anyone could see it was all over. I have no reason to mourn Mrs. McAndrew. I worked for her for a few days, but I didn't really know her, and it's not like she was tragically young. She was ancient. Still, it's sad that she was all alone in that big gloomy house, that she didn't have anyone to share her life with. I wonder if there was anyone she loved or trusted. If there was, she died without them. Nobody holding her hand, just a bunch of strangers standing around staring. Langlands, I think. What will happen to that? I suppose someone will inherit it, though they'll have to be found first. Hard to imagine anyone being thrilled about it. A crumbling old place with no proper heating or lighting, not even a phone line. In the meantime, though, the old house will just sit there, cold and silent, rotting away in the middle of the forest. And that's when I decide to go there.
I actually had goosebumps at points when you were reading that, Helen. Wonderful, absolutely tremendous. You know, and I was just sitting watching you both, listening to you both, and I just have this buzz thinking of all this amazing talent that we've got in Strathearn, and I just think it's been fantastic that the two of you have been able to meet up and share thoughts, and it's just been wonderful. Thank you both very, very much.
Thanks for listening. Join us next week for another episode of the Culture Perth and Kinross podcast. You can find out everything you need to know about what Culture Perth and Kinross has been up to on our website, www.culturepk.org.uk.